I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Allegra Love. She's an immigration attorney. She works with the Adelante program of the Santa Fe Public Schools, and she has recently returned from the border of Mexico and Guatemala. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So what took you to this border where there's a heck of a lot of activity going on right now?
I read an article. I used to volunteer with an organization called No Más Muertes, No More Deaths, on the Arizona-Mexico border, helping in migrant camps for people who are crossing the desert into our country from Mexico. And I read a newsletter about a shelter on the border of Guatemala and Mexico, in Mexico, in Tenosique, Tabasco, where they were offering assistance to migrants who are coming up from Central America and trying to make the long journey north across Mexico to arrive in the United States. And I was interested and inspired, so I bought an airplane ticket and went down to offer my services.
What did you find when you got there?
It was very, very horrifying. And also, you know, not horrifying. It was a lot of wonderful people I met there too. But essentially, what the place I was staying at is called La 72, so the 72, and it's a migrant shelter run by Franciscan friars, radical Franciscan friars. And essentially, it's about 50 miles from Guatemala, and it's right on the side of the train tracks, and it's the first jumping on point for migrants who want to get on La Bestia, the beast, the death train, the freight train that rumbles from Guatemala all the way to the USA, and that migrants climb on to make the journey. And so migrants would come in walking, sometimes by truck, from the Guatemalan border, mostly Hondurans, because we were on the eastern side of Mexico. So I would say 98% Hondurans in this camp, hundreds and hundreds of people. And they would come walking, and sometimes a coyote would drop them off, or they would come in a truck or on a bus sometimes. And they would stay and rest and talk and eat food, get clothes, get shoes, get medical care, and wait for the beast to come through. And it would honk its horn coming out of the mountains of Chiapas, and then there it would be, and everyone would jump on and disappear over the horizon.
Now, this train is dangerous for so many different reasons.
Yes. The obvious first danger is death. People die with frequency riding the Bestia. Essentially, they fall off, and they get run over. And they lose limbs.
This is not a passenger train, ladies and gentlemen.
No, they're riding on top, they're riding in between, they're riding on the sides. Yeah. You can easily find photos of this. It's very well documented, this train. People lose arms, legs, they become handicapped, they die. And that's the first danger, the actual physical danger of riding a freight train. You can't sleep, there's no food, there's no water, you don't know when it's coming, you don't know when it's leaving, and so you're at this train's mercy. There's no schedule. Now, the problem also is it's under the control of the gangs, too. So there are quotas that you have to pay. I don't know if that's the word, but fees to board it. Certain checkpoints across Mexico, you have to pay about $100 U.S. to keep going, or you risk violence, assault. You can be kidnapped. It's a well-known migrant route, and anywhere that there's a well-known migrant route is going to be in the hands of violent criminals and people who want to take advantage of migrants. Women are regularly raped on this route. Children are in the hands of smugglers. People are lost. People are separated. People are hungry, exhausted. It's extraordinarily dangerous. And even if everything goes well, it's probably like a 10-12 day journey. But if things don't go as planned, it could take 30 days, months to go from across Mexico.
Not to mention the Mexican police.
Sure. And one of the amazing things about the shelter I was at was that they really, really, really encourage migrants to denuncias, make reports against Mexican police and Mexican migration who have abused them at all. And theoretically how it works is if you make a report against the Mexican police, if you've been assaulted, you can gain free passage across Mexico, a short visa to arrive at the U.S. border on a regular passenger bus. You can go through migration checkpoints, all of that.
And some people are also robbed by the police.
Robbed by the police. One thing I was hearing a lot when I was doing intake was a lot of people were robbed by Guatemalan migration too, when they were crossing the border in. And so to avoid being assaulted or robbed by migration, you take a route around the migration gate, and who's waiting for you there? Criminals who want to take advantage of you and rob you.
And so this is the situation, and the logical next question is, who would ever leave their homeland, their families, their friends, in order to go toward that?
Right. This is the excellent question, you know? So from, you know, you can find this out in the media, but I'm going to speak directly to what the people in the shelter told me. Honduras is on its knees. It's in a state of complete collapse. And people are being killed indiscriminately, mercilessly in Honduras, especially in Tegucigalpa, in San Pedro Sula. Entire neighborhoods are being wiped out. Villages are being threatened. And some people are fleeing a direct threat to their life. They've received calls, text messages. They found out that their life is in danger, so they have to flee. A lot of people are leaving before they have the direct threat. They've seen enough family members killed, neighbors killed. They've seen too many children cut down in the streets, shot down in the streets, where they're not going to wait around any longer to wait for it to affect their immediate family.
There's also people who are being essentially forced to make the choice between joining a gang, which they don't want to do, or having their family threatened or killed.
Right. So there's the gang is actively recruiting young men, teenagers, and like 12-year-old children to join the gang. And if you resist, you will be killed. And so Honduras is a dangerous place for anyone in the world to be right now, but it's especially dangerous for young men like 12 to 25 who are not interested in joining the Mara.
What is the nature of these gangs? What do they do and how do they act?
I'm not an expert on this, and I just can tell you, like, you hear stories where it's kind of like what you hear about Juarez too. Like, they want something from you, and if they don't get it, they kill you. It's highly organized. It's a highly sophisticated criminal operation. But you also have to wonder how much, if that culture is what's predominant, how much of that trickles down into just how people deal with their problems in general. When people are being killed in the street, that's how conflicts are being sorted out in that country. But yeah, one woman was telling me her father had a pretty lucrative business and basically was taxed out of it by the gangs, like every day had to pay someone until the point where he had no money left, and then he was shot in the head, and before he died, they made sure he knew that they were going after his family next, and that's when they left.
Right. And so when you hear stories like that, and they are innumerable,
that is the norm. And of course there are people who are fleeing because there's just no work. They can't support their family, and it's just they have to try something because there's absolutely no way to buy food.
And even if you have, as you say, a lucrative business, essentially the mob, the mafia, the gang, whatever you want to call it, takes 80 to 90% of your salary.
I don't know the figure, but it's you ask people, everyone just says there's nothing left for me there. I can't live there.
Right.
Honduras is on its knees, and these are regular people. In fact, they're some of the wealthier people because it's an expensive journey. And the poorest of the poor can't afford to leave because they can't afford the journey. So we're looking at, I don't know if it's middle class, but we're looking at actually people who still have some resources, or at least have family members in the U.S. who can help finance it.
And so I think it's really important to make the distinction, we're talking to immigration attorney Allegra Love, to make the distinction between those who come here, quote unquote, looking for a better life and end up in service industries in really virtually every city in the United States.
Yeah.
And to my view, that's fine because that's how this country has always been and will probably always be, is that people come from elsewhere and build the next generation and are discriminated against and then assimilate and then the next generation from somewhere else is discriminated. All of that, that's like a very well-known set of phenomena. But this is not so much a looking for a better life situation as really more of a refugee situation.
Right, and that's, I'm really glad you pointed that out, because I think one of the problems with the media portrayal of this crisis right now is they're not doing a good job drawing a distinction between the phenomena of Mexican immigration that's happening in our country right now and this. There's a lot of people who for some time have been very, very, very angry about Mexican migration into this country. And it's a complicated issue. And it is very much based on economic well-being and whether or not someone has the right to migrate to another country in search of better work and for the well-being of their family. But this is not that. We're talking about a humanitarian refugee crisis where people are fleeing for their lives. They're choosing an absolutely dangerous journey over staying where they are because they are afraid that they're going to be killed.
Now, you talked to people who had come from Honduras and were in this essentially safe house, safe space.
Yeah, it was very safe.
Where you were working. And so what did you do there? I mean, you went to donate your services. What did you do each day?
Well, ostensibly I was there because I wanted to give orientations to migrants on how to ask for asylum in the United States, the issues around asylum in the United States, what to expect if they were detained, also to meet children and talk to them about the children's special rights. But what I found in talking about their rights is there's a lot of gossip and rumors about how people would be treated when they arrived in the United States. That's, I don't want to say it's fueling the migration, but they have really incorrect expectations about what their arrival in the United States will look like. And so I spent a lot of time talking, dispelling these sort of myths about how the United States was going to receive women and children when they arrived. And then, of course, outside of that, food, water, clothing, medical assistance, love, that kind of stuff.
What are these rumors? What are they expecting?
You know, I think the most pervasive one is that women and children are going to be released from detention to live in the United States with impunity. Women and children are being released in one manner or another in some cases because there's no official policy about this, but if they lack bed space, if the women and children have family in the United States, they're sometimes released on their own recognizance to await their deportation outside of detention. But they're not being released to live and work in the United States in peace. They are still in the process of deportation. And that's what people don't understand. Also, there's no rule about it. Just as easily as a woman could be released into the United States to go live with her family wherever they may be, she could also be deported swiftly back into her country without very much due process.
What is the actual law about due process?
Well, it depends. But the biggest problem on our border is that immigration violations are civil violations. If they were criminal, criminal rights would attach, and we would be required to provide a lawyer. Immigration violations are civil violations, and you are not entitled to or given a lawyer to represent you. And so most people who enter and detained are then deported have never had contact with a lawyer, and they do this thing called expedited removal where they try and make it very swift and painless, and they reduce penalties a little bit if the person's willing to sign an expedited removal order and just get the heck out of there. You know, you always have the right to contest your case, but that could be months and months and months and months of sitting in detention. And so they present them with this, we can have you out of here in a few days if you just sign this paper, your expedited removal. And so when given the choice of sitting in detention, not knowing what's going to happen to you, or returning home, when your objective is protecting your family, for a lot of people, that's a really, really clear choice.
It's funny. I mean, it sounds like, to the uninitiated person like me, it sort of sounds like being in detention for a couple of months sounds a lot better than riding on the back of a death train.
But again, there aren't a lot of people who are explaining all of this. Now, if you come and ask for asylum, it's a different process. But that just sort of like depends on how credible your story is, how much the U.S. believes that you're actually afraid for your life upon your arrival. The biggest issue that we're seeing with due process on our border right now is in the camps full of kids, because children going up against a United States attorney in front of an immigration judge without representation is a horrifying thing. And they're estimating, people are estimating that the majority of these kids actually do have claims to stay in the United States, whether it's asylum, whether it's trafficking cases, some sort of international convention, special immigrant juvenile status, but they won't be able to access those claims without really good legal counsel and screening, and that takes time and money. And when there's 50,000 kids in detention, it becomes this whole other crisis trying to get them due process.
Now, are there attorneys who are donating their time to these kids?
Yes.
There must be a lot of them.
I don't know that there's a lot. I don't know. I'm trying right now to get clearance to go to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. I'd like to go to Artesia. I haven't quite figured out how. It's not totally obvious to me, but then again, I just returned to the country. But it's not totally obvious to me how a lawyer gets access to these centers. There's plenty of shelters that are non-governmental, Catholic Church shelters, where people, when they're releasing people, they're putting them into the shelters where a lawyer can go and volunteer. But it's a little unclear to me, for example, our new shelter, our new camp in Artesia, how as a lawyer I would get access to the migrants there for representing them.
Another issue that I would think comes up is, let's say somebody does apply for asylum because they think they're going to be killed. They're not going to have brought with them evidence. What kind of evidence could you have? So it's basically storytelling.
Yeah, and the first interview you have for asylum hearing is a credible fear interview. And that is a lower standard than the actual asylum case. And so you're allowed to tell your story to an immigration officer, and if they feel your story is credible and that you actually have fear, they will open an asylum case for you. And that will give you time to gather evidence and build your case. And the backlog of asylum cases right now in the United States is so massive that people are waiting years. Once they are assigned an asylum case, a hearing in front of the judge, it will be years from when they enter and declare their intent to be a political asylee.
And where are they living in the meantime?
You know, sometimes they're detained, but a lot of times they're released into communities where their family is living, if they have family, and they're allowed to, they check in every few months with the local immigration office, and we actually extend certain benefits to, some federal benefits to people who are awaiting asylum cases. But again, it's important to point out, most asylum cases from Central America are not accepted. It's a very, very, very low approval rate, in the 5% maybe. That's a general thing. I don't know what the exact figure are, but it's a Central American asylum claim because of gang violence is almost impossible to win.
And so what happens to the people who cases are rejected?
They are deported.
And they go back to Honduras?
Yes. Unless they can find another, claim for relief in the United States. But if they can't, they are deported.
And then they go back to Honduras. Do you ever see people turning around and coming back again?
In Tenosique, in the La Santa de Dios, where I was, I met a man who had been living in Kansas, I think for some time, because he spoke English very well. He's from Honduras. And he was for 2 months in detention in the U.S. When he was deported to Honduras, he stayed in Tegucigalpa for 3 hours and boarded a bus and started back, because he was very certain that he would be murdered if he stayed. Based on something, you know, family, whatever, he said he could not be in the country of Honduras, and he was out of the country within 4 hours.
Talk about fear for your life.
Right.
I mean, think about that. Think about being deported to your country of origin, where you presumably have family, cousins, aunts, uncles, friends, and you don't even stay there long enough to greet them, update them, and say, okay, I'm going back.
Yeah. And some kids don't even tell their parents when they're leaving. They just take off. And so we, as adults, we think about making this journey. Now imagine you're a 14-year-old kid by yourself. There are girls doing this alone.
How do people survive for even one day, much less 10 days, much less 30 days on this freight train?
They stick together. They're shelters. They're shelters all along the route. They carry small amounts of money. People throw food and water at them. They rely on the help of coyotes, which is crazy, relying on the help of just merciless criminals. Coyotes will leave you in just to die if you slow them down or anything happens like that, but they rely on the help of coyotes. They get members of their family to wire them money at certain points because you can't carry too much money because you'll just be robbed. So you have to, you know, one of the things we helped at the shelter was having money sent to people so they could get through the first leg of their trip and pay the gangs and afford a little bit of food.
So they're essentially getting off the train and getting on again and getting off and getting on again.
And, I mean, the Red Cross and Grupo Beta, which is a Mexican sort of agency that helps with migrants, I think they assist to a certain extent with the humanitarian aspect of this, giving water, food, medical care alongside of the train.
How would you like to see this crisis addressed, both in the media and in terms of policy?
Well, the policy question's very, very complicated. If someone like me could think of a really good answer, we wouldn't be in this crisis right now. But I would like to see the narrative be one of compassion and horror at what is happening to this country and these people, rather than characterizing it as an invasion. I mean, that is the first thing I would like to see. It is very, very complicated. The whole crisis is a complicated, tense situation that's been building for 30 years, 40 years, you know? And I'm completely confused by it. And I'm an immigration attorney. But what I'm not confused about is that when I see people holding signs up against children on our border, when I read our politicians saying that they're going to deport women and children as fast as possible back into this country, my heart isn't confused. And I know that that is not the right thing to do. That we can... There are communities in the United States that will offer aid and welcome and be generous. I encourage the average person who hears about this to trust their own hearts with this. I've been talking to a lot of people and they say... I think when they see the way our government's behaving, they think there's something they don't understand. There's something complicated about that they don't understand. Their heart feels sick. They feel heartbroken. How can we be sending kids back into a place where they're going to get killed? It just can't be that simple. But it is. And they may not be experts about immigration law or experts about refugee crises, but when you hear those stories and your heart sinks and you feel sick, that's the right reaction.
Yeah.
And I don't think we are saying that enough to each other and getting together and saying that enough to each other. That if you hear that and you say, no, 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 these aren't my values, I don't want those kids, it's not, you're right. And it's okay to say that. And when the government says we can't possibly help these people, it's okay to say, why not? And say, I want to help these people.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, if somebody said, here's a 9-year-old, take care of them for the next 3 months, I'd do it in a heartbeat.
I would be like, there's 50,000 kids. Are you telling me there wouldn't be waiting lists of people who would gladly care for that child rather than put them alone on a plane back to Tegu to wait and see if they're going to die or wait till their parents can raise enough money to have them do it all over again? And I think that's the American value, that kind of spirit, that we would gladly take someone in, buy them cereal and milk, drive them to school, you know, help them out. That is the values that our country has, and it's not being shown in the headlines. It's not being represented when the media paints it as this very, very complicated issue. It is complicated, but the compassion and generosity that we all feel and want, everyone I know is desperate to show that compassion and generosity to these people. That's not complicated.
We're talking to immigration attorney Allegra Love about what's going on the southern border of Mexico. There's also another piece that I think is really important to talk about, and that is that we have different countries with different borders, but these countries are interrelated, and a policy decision 30 years ago, a policy decision 10, 20 years ago, has consequences.
Yeah.
And so you have, for example, all of this military aid to Central America under Ronald Reagan to basically attack socialist democracies or prop up right-wing military, essentially dictatorships. And it was a horror show. And then all of these people ended up coming to the United States. Some of them turned into gangsters on the streets of LA. They're deported back to their countries in Central America, and then you wonder why there's gangs in Central America mm-hmm. now.
Exactly.
These things are related, and they're related to U.S. policy,
yeah.
and that's part of the complexity that you're talking about that needs to be discussed and understood. I mean, I watch these sort of, I mean, it's a really bad use of time, but I sometimes watch these Facebook threads yeah. where people are saying, why don't those people just go back to their countries? And it's like, no, we are in a relationship
mm-hmm.
with them.
Mm-hmm. And saying, why don't they just go back to their country, kind of illustrates how most of us, I can't speak for everyone, but I would say most Americans don't really have a way to contextualize the level of violence and poverty that these folks are fleeing. We hear violent, we hear poor, we have an image in our head of what that is. And this
from
is
television.
From TV or from, you know, like maybe we spend some time in the inner cities of this country, which are certainly bad, and I don't wish that suffering on anyone. That's not what I'm saying. But this is, from everything that I listened to, this is so beyond what we as the United States public can understand as like a daily life. The fear, the violence, the cheapness of life is we couldn't possibly understand it.
Another part of it is that a lot of these gangs are essentially drug cartels, and the market for drugs is also the United States.
Yeah, and I wish I could speak more about that. I mean, but yeah, we have a thirst for drugs, and all of this cartel business hinges on the drug trade. And in a way, we are very, very complicit in their continued power. But also human trafficking, and that's the other thing, is that's another really, really big complication, is if we welcome people into the United States and do give them refuge, we are growing the human trafficking business in Mexico and Central America. We are making the $5,000-$7,000 that a parent in Honduras pays to have their child smuggled by a criminal across countries and countries a good investment. And so that's one of the things that makes this very, very, very complicated.
There's yet another dimension that I think we need to talk about, and that is just inequality. When you've got a really relatively rich country, though Lord knows fewer and fewer of us really partake of that wealth, but when you have right next door really poor countries, it is a magnet no matter what. And you're going to have people not just who are poor and who are struggling to survive, but you are going to inevitably have corruption of the kind that, you know, police are extorting money from ordinary citizens or from people coming through. You're going to have this crazy hypocrisy where on the one hand, for example, Mexico wants people to be able to go to the United States, but they don't want Guatemalans and Hondurans to come into Mexico. You're going to have every kind of illegal economic activity happening.
Yeah.
And there's sort of this myth, I think, on the part of the, for lack of a better word, 1%, that we can just have an ever greater movement toward inequality and it's okay and the rest of us will just valiantly struggle.
Obviously not. And it's just, what you're saying, all the things you're saying, they're all symptoms of desperation. It's like you said earlier, nobody wants to leave their country and their family and where they're comfortable if they don't have to. But the state of inequality is so bad. I mean, you can make in a day here in the United States what you earn in a week or sometimes a month in Honduras. And people need to eat. People need clean water. People need to pay off criminals to stay alive. And so the lure of coming here and earning money, there's no amount of deterrence that is going to stop someone. I heard the friars who ran the shelter estimated to me that there's a between 1% and 5% chance that someone leaving their home country, crossing Mexico, and will arrive without being killed, detained, or deported. It's a 1 to 5% chance that they're actually going to arrive without detection to work in the United States. So if there's at best a 95% fail rate in this journey, what amount of deterrence is going to work? Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, our government saying, we just have to make it really, really clear to them that they can't do this. We need to make it more dangerous, more difficult, so they understand. No. It's already pretty much impossible, and people are still leaving their countries by the thousands.
I think you call that fighting fire with fire.
Yeah. What are we going to cut that down to 0.1% success rate of them coming? They'll still come.
Yeah.
When you're choosing between death or not death, or choosing between starving and maybe not starving, you choose maybe.
Yeah, the choice between death and maybe death.
You choose maybe death.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I don't know. I've never had to make that choice, but I assume. I mean, that's basically what everyone was telling me down there.
We're talking to immigration attorney Allegra Love. Tell us about some of the individuals whom you met.
Well, I met a woman with a 2-month-old baby. And she was with her husband, her 2-month-old baby, and her 9-year-old son. And they were still in the shelter when I left because I think they had come across on a bus and walked in or came in a truck to that point. And then the reality of bringing a 2-month-old baby on that train was a little... They were still in the shelter when I left, and several trains had passed. They had left two of their kids, an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old, in Honduras with relatives. And they were planning on bringing the two up, returning, and bringing the other two up. These people were really brave. I met a 6-year-old who was with some adults. I don't know if it was one of them was his mother. It wasn't totally clear. He was in the care of adults, and he was really, really, really brave. And we tried to find him a ride. I was up on the border, and we tried to find him a ride into the shelter, and we couldn't. We couldn't find him a ride. So he left us at 6 a.m. walking with some adults. And we finally found a truck, and we went looking for him, and he had walked 8 hours in the Mexican sun on a highway, about 30 miles, a 6-year-old, to try and arrive to safety. And 2 days later, he went with the migrants and disappeared. I don't know if they went on the train. I don't know if they were going with a coyote in another direction, but he spent 2 days eating cookies and drinking water, getting medical care, and then he disappeared again, 6 years old. And you had to say to him when they were leaving, okay, buddy, it's time to be really, really brave. And I think about my nieces and nephews and the kids that I know and having to have that, having to tell a kid that they have to be that kind of brave, it breaks your heart. And when I hear news stories, that's the kid whose face I see. This sweet, sweet, sweet boy.
The stories you're telling are absolutely heartbreaking. And I was thinking about what you were saying a moment ago about how when you think with your heart, you know what to do. And when you think about policy and history and with your head, it becomes very complicated. And there's a lot of really heartbreaking hatred on the part of a lot of Americans. You are reading story after story about anti-immigrant protesters who really don't get the refugee part of this at all.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention probably not even really getting the immigration story that well either, but never mind. But it strikes me that, like, this separation of heart and head thing, when you start thinking with your heart and trying to come up with ways to help and make policy with your heart, you start making better policies.
Certainly more humane ones, and certainly policies that reflect understanding of human dignity more than the ones we're presenting right now.
Human dignity, and I think we also have to talk about human rights, the right to simply live.
The right to migrate. Migration's a right. It really, really is, especially when you're fleeing a violent country. No one is required to stay in a place where their life is being threatened.
So what can people do who are listening or who care or who want to help?
Well, my first point of advice is to learn as much as you can about this crisis. Don't just read the headlines in national media. Take some time to search out the whole spectrum of views about it and to dig a little into what's going on. We live in this awesome time where a person can use social media to tell everyone they know about something that they've learned, and people can write things and publish things and be activists from sitting in front of a laptop, and that's a really, really important thing to harness. If you want to make donations, Catholic Charities in the Archdiocese of Santa Fe is accepting donations that they're sending down to the border, and that's ccasfnm.org. And you go to that website and it's like, poof, the top banner is, help out our kids in crisis. And if you don't want to donate to Catholic Charities, you know, they want in-kind donations and volunteers. But if you don't want to do that, my suggestion to people is to donate to an organization called Kids in Need of Defense, which is legal aid helping kids get due process who are unaccompanied and in immigration and detention in the United States. It's a national organization called Kids in Need of Defense. And when I get some money, that's where I'm going to send it. But I'm also going to do, like, shoe drives and toothpaste drives and stuff like that, diapers, to send down to the border through Catholic Charities.
Are there any benefits or anything coming up in Santa Fe?
You know, we're trying to work on that, the interfaith group, and, you know, I just talking with my, I have tons of Central American clients, and I've been calling them and talking to them and seeing if they have interest in their church groups of, you know, maybe a prayer event or a fundraising event. And I would really, really encourage people who have ideas or feel really excited to get in touch. And I will leave my email address to Mary Charlotte, because any amount of help is good to show that we are not a community that is hateful towards migrants. And also because it could be the matter of, it could be a survival matter for someone, the food and the clothing. And it could make someone's experience either completely miserable or slightly less miserable because they have clean clothing, underwear, diapers, they can brush their teeth, phone cards, stuff like that.
Now, you were, as you said, at a shelter run by Franciscan friars called La 72, 72. What about ordinary Mexican people in that area? Did you see them responding to this whole Honduran influx?
So Mexican response to Central American immigration is as complicated as American response to Mexican immigration is. They are concerned with the individual. They don't like to see people suffering, but they're also concerned with how their country can support this huge flow of migrants. The exact same arguments you hear good people making in the United States. But what the migrants like to say, and what was very apparent, is there are always good people. One of the most memorable moments, the most sort of stirring moments I had, was that we had traveled right to the border and set up a makeshift camp so that we could offer direct aid to people before they walked in, that we could give them food, water, hopefully a ride, tell them how long the walking trip was going to be, let them know there was safety down the road. And we saw like hundreds of people. But one night, we were in our makeshift camp in this very, very small village in Mexico, right on the border, called Pedregal, probably 30 homes. And they had these folks had been bringing us food the entire time, soup, tamales, they killed a pig, to make sure that we were comfortable so that we could support the migrants. And it was late at night, and it was pouring rain, like the kind of rain you only see in the tropics, and like 30 Honduran people came out of the night, and there were children with them and women alone. And they were so cold and wet, and it was dark. And we went to a Mexican home, and they turned on their light on the porch, and they had us wait under the shelter of their porch to stay dry while they found a key. And they opened up the shelter, this like a church for shelter, and they swept it out, And they let the migrants spend the night there, wait out the storm and wait out the night so they wouldn't have to walk through the dark and the cold and be completely vulnerable to whatever was waiting for them on the highway. And they helped us carry the kids so the kids' feet wouldn't get wet, and we wrapped the kids in blankets. And it was, for me, just the essence of what being in service to another person is, and the point of religion and what we try and teach ourselves about goodness and how to treat a stranger and how to treat a neighbor. And I've always felt that there's so many different kinds of generosity, but the most important is the generosity that someone shows when they also don't have enough for themselves. And that night was a really, really beautiful illustration of this. Very, very poor Mexican people opening up their community to share with people, even though they did not have enough for themselves. And I really think here in Santa Fe, we can do the same thing.
The whole symbolism, which of course is adopted by virtually any religion that I've ever heard of, you know, coming out of the darkness and shining a light mm-hmm. for others, was something you literally experienced
yeah.
on that night.
And it's like, it's stirring when I think about it, and it's hard not to cry.
Yeah. Well, the story of the 6-year-old boy.
Yeah.
What was his first name?
Walter.
So Walter is presumably somewhere right now.
Hopefully. Hopefully. I mean, he's in God's hands, but hopefully he's also in someone else's hands who's taking care of him. I hope it's his mom.
How did the Franciscan friars you were working with in La 72 get to do the kind of work they were doing?
They were assigned to do that work in the parish, in the town parish, and eventually the work turned into that shelter. And the shelter is expanding. They're building dormitories, they're building a basketball court, they're building better bathrooms and facilities for people. But the man who is directing it, his name is Fray Tomas, I don't know his full name, but he's extremely intelligent, extremely radical person. And he is standing up against the Mexican government to stand with his brothers and sisters in migration with absolute respect for their right to migrate, their respect to dignity. And he takes beatings for them. His life has been threatened. They have to have federal police stationed outside of the shelter at all time because his life has been threatened.
By whom?
Probably the gangs, criminals, people who don't like that he is aiding people in denouncing the crimes against them. Maybe the police, I don't know. He has led marches in, he led a caravan of people towards the capital, migrants together, just, and then they got turned around and just sort of attacked and turned around and sent back. But he's an absolute inspiration for me in his commitment to living with migrants and treating their problems as seriously as they are and treating them with the dignity that they deserve.
And I would like to point out that, of course, Franciscan friars, devotees of San Francisco de Assisi, who's the patron saint of Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm. There are actually 5 Franciscan friars there, and they were just lovely, lovely people.
Were there people like you volunteering from other countries?
There were 3 Mexican students from the university in DFA, and there was another American woman from Arizona, an activist, who had actually been there for 6 months, which is quite something based on how intense the work is there, that she had been there for 6 months.
Is there, that you know of, a movement among U.S. immigration attorneys to participate in this crisis?
I think it's growing. I think that we all are specially positioned to understand the crisis and offer our services. I'm a part of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and, you know, as a whole, as an organization, we have denounced this idea to send people back as quickly as possible. But I haven't heard the call yet as a huge organization that we need to go and donate our services. But it'll come. And the immigration bar in New Mexico has also just denounced the practice of expedited removal. But when the opportunity comes, I'm confident that immigration lawyers will answer the call.
Allegra Love is an immigration attorney. She works with the Adelante program in the Santa Fe Public Schools. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to play a song right now called La Bestia. This is a song about the migrant train that we've been talking about, La Bestia, the Beast. And it's been a great hit in Central America, but what you might not know, or the people listening to it might not know, it was actually produced by the United States to be part of a propaganda campaign that was designed to get people not to come to the United States. So let's hear now La Bestia.
Partes se atrincheran entre los rieles, muy lejos de donde vienen, más lejos de a dónde van. Esperan el temblar de la tierra, el chillido de las ruedas. Aparece tras la montaña, amenazadora serpiente. De acero son sus escamas, también de acero es su vientre. La bestia del sur le llama. Maldito tren de la muerte, con el diablo en la caldera, pita, ruge y se retuerce. Colgados en los vagones de la serpiente de acero, van migrantes como reces en camino al matadero. La ruta del infierno, entre humos de dolores, este trueno que no conoce de favores. Lleva 3 6 tatuados en sus ruedas y su frente. La bestia del sur le llama al maldito tren de la muerte, con el diablo en la caldera, pita, ruge y se retuerce. Trucha, quincena de coyotes, un mortero que machaca, un machete que descaja. Con el diablo en la caldera, pita, ruge y se retuerce.